Hello everybody and welcome to NPC Cast. On today's episode, we speak to game designer Jerry Hawthorne about his game Mice and Mystics and about how he got his start in the game industry. It is March 29th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 13 of NPC Cast.
You are now listening to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPC Cast. My name is Chris, and I am coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. I, of course, have brought some other NPCs along for the ride with me. To my left is NPC Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing today?
Chill.
Do you have a baby yet?
No.
Almost?
I hope so. It's 5 days overdue.
Your baby's going to be in kindergarten before it's born.
I was thinking, I asked Anna if we could just raise it on the inside.
Raise it on the inside.
Yeah, she just starts going to school again, like with a microphone or like amplifier
Skype.
Sound. Yeah.
Oh my god, that's horrible. I'm done with you. Coming to us from the frozen tundra of the north is NPC Dell. Dell, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's almost warm.
It's getting there. It's quite close, yeah.
Soon it's going to be like the thawed tundra of the north.
Well, it's permafrost.
Oh, okay.
Very cool. So we have a special episode today. Today we're going to be interviewing Jerry Hawthorne, the designer of Mice and Mystics.
I'm jazzed.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty sweet. This is one of Aaron's like current favorite games right now. So
yeah, I'll have to try like not to gush, you know, endlessly about how much I love his
game. Why would we start now? We are
start trying. Why would we start trying now?
Trying not to.
Oh, okay.
So by the way, if you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, you can give us a review there on iTunes. You can give us a thumbs up on Stitcher. We really appreciate it. We also have our Twitters. My Twitter is @NPCChris.
I'm @NPCAaron.
And I am @NPCDell. Be sure if you're going to tweet at the show to tweet @NPCDell so I can get my clout score higher.
What is? Do you have a clout score? What is your clout score for like games?
I don't have games as something I'm influential about, but I do have Magic as something
obviously
influential about.
Wait, Magic? Is it something you're influential about?
And
what's your clout score for Magic?
You just have one clout score, which is -61. Which is not bad. And then people tag you with things that you are influential about.
So -61 is not bad?
No, he said mine is 61.
Oh, okay. I was going to be like, is this golf? What kind of game is this?
The lower the clout score, the better.
But for real, though, you can tweet @NPCCast. That's the official real Twitter, and we'll see it there as well.
You can also catch us on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
That's facebook.com/NPCcast, or you can email us
at thenpccast@gmail.com. The Facebook thing, we have a contest going on right now. If you like us between now and April 2nd, you have the chance to win a $25 gift card to cardkingdom.com. If you're in the Seattle area, that could be a gift card for the physical store, which is beautiful, or for the online store. If you're not from Seattle area, I guess you could still get the physical card if you want, but we're not going to give you a plane ticket or anything like that. You just get the card.
No.
So there
cost
you go.
Prohibitive. We thought about it. Overhead was too high.
We did.
We're business savvy here. That's what we're saying.
Exactly. You done now?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, cool. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of this episode, and that is our interview with Jerry Hawthorne, and we will start that for you right a nap. We have, of course, as we mentioned at the top of the show, a special guest, one Jerry Hawthorne, designer of Mice and Mystics from Plaid Hat Games. He's coming from Dallas, Texas, I believe. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Howdy, y'all.
that's the one thing. I think it was Aaron who said that he's going to be very disappointed if you didn't sound very, very Texas.
Well, I'm not originally from Texas, so, but I fit in pretty good.
You get a pass this time, Hawthorne.
Aaron, you know I am from Texas, right?
I mean, kind of, Del. You moved to Florida when you were like 3 or something.
3 months, but yeah. I was born in Austin. That's like Texas.
That's the best part of Texas.
Keep Austin weird.
So, Jerry, as I mentioned, is the designer of Mice and Mystics. But for the people who don't know sort of your history in the game design industry, can you give us like a brief synopsis of how you got your start in game design, Jerry?
Well, sure. Yeah. And I'll be brief. You know, I've been a board game fan, miniature game fan for many years, but probably around 2002, 2003, I started to get involved in the internet and finding out that there are game groups and game designers out there. And so I just kind of started volunteering my time to help anybody with anything they wanted help with, mostly in the form of playtesting. And that kind of led to me being more comfortable with playtesting and helping people out with their game designs and stuff. And I fiddled around with my own designs, but none of them were of any caliber at all. And then in 2004, I discovered HeroScape when I was shopping for gifts for my nephews, and I fell in love with the game. And shortly after I discovered the game, a website popped up called HeroScape.net, I think. And I joined their forum, and I was like one of the first few people there. And I, because of that, I got to meet Craig Van Ness and Rob Dabio and a few other people. And I got invited to be a playtester when the game became more popular and they needed playtesters. And then from then on, I just kind of weaseled my way in.
For people that don't know, HeroScape was made by Hasbro, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and that was it was kind of a miniatures game with a kind of all-inclusive setting, if I recall correctly.
Oh, forgive me. I just assume everybody knows what HeroScape is all about. Basically, HeroScape is a board game, but the board is made out of these hexagon-shaped interlinking plastic little pieces that you build a three-dimensional board that kind of looks like an outdoor area where you could fight a battle. And you build these just however you want to build it out of these little hexagon shapes, and they stack up on top of each other and they link into each other. They're kind of like Legos in a way. And so there's that Lego element to it, and it has a huge toy factor. But you build these enormous elaborate battlefields with trees and all this different terrain. And then you have these little miniature figurines, and they represent little heroes and squads of units fighting each other from all throughout time. And it's just a real simple, real casual beer and pretzels kind of game. But it has a charm to it that just sort of sucks people in. And I was one of the first of those who got sucked in. And you know, I still love the game. I mean, I think it's fantastic. But that was where I got in. And that's how I got to know some people at Hasbro. And through Hasbro, through my connections at Hasbro, I was able to get work. And then that one thing led to another, and that's how I got into board game design.
Something about HeroScape that I thought was really awesome. At the time when HeroScape was really coming out, I was actually working for Toys R Us, and we carried HeroScape in Toys R Us. And it sort of reminded me of when I was younger, there was a lot of games that Milton Bradley did specifically that were sort of carried in these big box toy stores. Some stuff that I saw that were mentioned that you had been a fan of, Jerry, was like, for example, HeroQuest. That was sort of a Games Workshop, Milton Bradley kind of crossover game. And I think that's a niche that I don't know if there's anything out in this day and age that's sort of like that. I don't know if there's a place where a kid can go to a toy store and pull something off the shelf and have that be sort of their gateway into this tabletop gaming hobby. Can you explain a little bit about your experience with these older Milton Bradley games, Jerry?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I like games that are real simple to play, where you don't have a lot of stuff to remember, and they lend themselves more towards just interacting with each other and stuff. And so there's always a big part of my desire to play games comes from that part of me that just desires those experiences like I had when I was a kid. Thunder Road is a fantastic game. I own two copies of this doggone thing. I love the game. I've customized my pieces. I have various different versions and expansions that I've made myself to go with the game and stuff. I just think it's a fantastic game. I like that kind of thing where the cleverness of the game is wrapped into the way the mechanics fold in on themselves, so that you have this simple set of dice that do everything in the game that needs to be done. I love that sort of thing. And so those are the kind of games that I gravitate towards.
NPC Chris once told me that he hacked Thunder Road into a game that he and his friends played an entire campaign of, where they would like upgrade their cars and and stuff over the course of many game sessions.
One of my first ever sort of forays into just, you know, casual game design was a hack of Thunder Road, where my friend had this game and we're like, oh, this is an awesome mechanic. We love like the board flipping mechanic. And if you guys have never played Thunder Road, Thunder Road is basically like Mad Max, or sort of a racing game, but you have two long board pieces. And the clincher is that once you get to the end of the second one, everything that's on that first one still gets flipped over and destroyed. And then that becomes like the road ahead of you. So the road just keeps going. It's the endless road. And then eventually there's, you know, only a couple cars left or whatever. And then you have your winner. But yeah, we went through and we did a whole basically campaign setup of Thunder Road. We played with the Micro Machines and we had like, you know, different themes to our cars and everything like that. It was pretty fun. Now, when you got into HeroScape, what drew you into that specifically from a player standpoint? Because, like I said, when I was working at Toys R Us at the time, and I sort of didn't really give it a second look. To me, I didn't know that it was any deeper than what it appeared to be. But now, when I was researching, you know, your career, there's a tons of people that still love this game to this day and still play it.
Yes. In fact, I'm still an administrator over at HeroScapers.com, although I don't do anything admin-wise over there, but I pop in every once in a while and chit-chat with the guys over there. But what drew me in is, first of all, there's some credentials behind HeroScape. The guy that that created HeroQuest, his name is Stephen Baker. He also was part of the initial design of HeroScape. It has that name tied to it. So, when I discovered HeroScape, it was, while reading up about it on the New York City Toy Fair, before the game was actually released. And, I started like investigating about it and trying to find out any information I could about it. And, I saw some similarities in the dice mechanics and stuff that, that really matched up well with the, with HeroQuest. And then, after I did some digging around, sure enough, I found out that Stephen Baker was involved with the initial idea of HeroScape. And, you know, I just love Stephen Baker. I love the fact that he's a very intelligent and very, you know, he's just a very bright individual, but he creates these wonderfully simple games. And I love that.
In our last interview, I talked about how like simplicity and like elegance are like the things that, make me love games, because if I can't teach the game to my wife, who's not a huge board game fan, so she doesn't have the patience to learn like a, you know, a really fiddly mechanically game, if I can't teach it to her, I don't get to play it very often and it sits on my shelf. So you know, I when I bought, you know, Mice and Mystics, it was very easy to like it, you know, because it's like, hey, these are the dice and they handle, like you mentioned, you like it when one set of dice handles everything. And you're like, these dice handle, you know, pretty much any element of random chance you need them to. That's my idea of like a good mechanic, is that kind of all encompassing simplicity.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's jump forward a little bit. So you were able to start working for Hasbro and start working on some HeroScape stuff. Mm-hmm. Where does Plaid Hat Games factor into your career? When did that come along?
Well, when I was an admin at the first HeroScape website, there was a young gentleman that came on to our website. He was very enthusiastic and very young and very talented at creating custom additions for the game HeroScape, and his name is Colby Dauk. And we immediately started collaborating on all these different add-ons that we were making for HeroScape. So everybody knows I'm a huge proponent of creativity, and when you own a game, adding to it and creating and customizing your game, to me that's just joy. And so I'm all about house rules and fostering as much creativity as possible. And so Colby and I worked on a lot of stuff together, and then Hasbro was looking for more playtesters, and so naturally I recommended Colby, and as soon as he got brought on as a playtester at Hasbro, they saw how bright he was and how awesome his creations were, and so he immediately started getting work at Hasbro, small jobs doing you know, designing stuff. And then finally that blossomed into even more jobs with Hasbro. And both of us started getting work at, with Hasbro, just doing some freelance design stuff. For me, it was mostly content design. Basically, I would create content when they were doing an expansion for HeroScape. They would need all this content created, cards and whatnot, and so I would help with that. And then finally, Colby spun off, and he designed a game, and he tried to get Hasbro to publish it, but they didn't want it. And so his only recourse was to start his own game company, and he created Plaid Hat Games. And I guess the rest is sort of history. I created Mice and Mystics, and Colby wanted to publish it, and that's how it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the story is really, it's really inspiring, I think, to a lot of, you know, would-be game designers, because really you came from a place where it's like, you know, you were passionate about the game, you were active in the forums and active in the community first, and that sort of, that passion almost by itself got you your foot in the door to Hasbro, and then got you, of course, you know, your contacts with in Plaid Hat. And then, of course, now we get to Mice and Mystics, which is the game that you designed and then was published by Plaid Hat. Explain to us a little bit about where the idea from Mice and Mystics came from. I read a little bit of the backstory of it from your interview on BoardGameGeek. But for our listeners who might not be privy to that information, can you explain sort of where the idea came from for that game?
Sure, yeah. I would just like to make one little note about what you said earlier about getting your foot in the door in this business. I don't know if any game designers out there have really ever filled out a resume or, you know, put in an application for a job of game designer. It just doesn't happen. The way that you get into this industry is through networking and through service and paying dues the old-fashioned way. It's all about, you know, what you can do and how you can help and who you know, I think. Moving on to Mice and Mystics and the way it originated, I was asked by Colby if I had any game design ideas, because as a fledgling publishing company, he knew that he couldn't just, he's only one man, and so he can only really focus on Summoner Wars, but he knew that he had to spread out and have, you know, a good base of a variety of games for his publishing company to take off. He asked me if I had any game design ideas, and I at first I told him no, but I had been toying around with this idea in my head, a game design idea in my head. It came about because my daughter was struggling learning how to read when she was little, and I was at my wit's end trying to figure out how to help her read, and I was convinced that it was just that she wasn't reading the right subject matter, and she was real fidgety when she was reading, and I thought, you know, and it always seemed to help to like get her up and move her around and then and break up the reading into small chunks. And so I thought, golly, what if I created a game that took reading and then broke it up into little chunks, and in between those chunks you would have a little bit of a gameplay going on that would relate to what you just read, so that it would keep you involved, but it'd also give you an activity that would use your brain in different ways so that she could stay engaged with the reading. And it would help demonstrate in sort of a three-dimensional visual way what was going on with what you just read. And at first, my design idea was a lot more educational. Then one day, my friend Chad Hoveter, he's a sculptor for Plaid Hat Games, he was doing an exercise on improving his sculpting abilities, and he asked me to give him an idea for a sculpture. And I said, yeah, dude. Sculpt a little warrior mouse with like a big sword or a big axe or something. He's like, oh, great idea. A couple of weeks later, he comes up and he's got this little, you guys know what a green is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got this little green. It's a little sculpture made out of green putty that that they use when they make molds. And it just was bad to the bone. This cool little mouse. I still have it. It's just a cool little mouse with a big old battle axe in his hand. And a little determined expression on his face. And so I posted pictures of it to this, I belong to this private board game design forum. I posted the picture on there, and then Colby saw the picture and he called me up and he's like, what is this picture of? What is this all about? And then I told him, he's like, I thought you didn't have any game design ideas. I said, well, I've just been kind of goofing around with this little thing. And I told him the story about how I had gotten Chad to sculpt that miniature, and he said, pitch it to me. I said, pitch it to you? He said, pitch me the game. Pitch me the game idea. I want to hear it. So I told him about it, and then he just sat there quietly listening to me over the phone. And then when I was done, he said, I want to publish that game. Do you think you can have a prototype of ready by Gen Con, which is about 6 months away? And so, like a fool, I said yes. And then I had to burn the midnight oil
yeah,
to try to create a game that was playable in 6 months. So I had to have it playable. So I showed up to Gen Con with my playable prototype of Mice and Mystics. And I only had two chapters written for it. And I had only, I think, four or five of the eight tiles designed at that time. But it was playable, so you could actually play and get a gist of what the game is about.
Yeah, that was one of my questions about it. I'm always interested when I see a game that the theme is carried through to the mechanics so cleanly. I always wonder if, you know, was it the theme or the mechanics that came first? So in this case, you know, in the beginning, how did you lay out the story of Mice and Mystics versus the mechanics? Which did you focus on first?
Everything in Mice and Mystics starts with a story. The game design started with a story. At first, Mice and Mystics was like my when I realized that this is a game and there is a game here. I wanted the game to sort of be like my love letter to those old style games like we just talked about, like HeroQuest in particular.
Yeah.
But done with my own vision and done with my own heart and soul put into it, and not to be a copycat, but sort of, you know, to be like a, you know, a new era version of those old style games mm-hmm. that involved a lot of dice rolling and a lot of, you know, moments and a lot of emergent narrative and stuff. And so, but everything in Mice and Mystics starts with a story. So I knew I wanted to make it about mice since my daughter was so into mice at the time. She had a couple of pet mice and she had like 15 gazillion stuffed animals that were all different sized mice in her room. She had names for all of them. So I knew I had to make it about mice, but I didn't really, I mean, I was familiar with Redwall, but I didn't really know much more than that. And, so Redwall was like probably the closest thing I had for inspiration. And then I thought, well, what if, you know, I wanted the characters not to be like Redwall. I wanted them to be like Dungeons and Dragons characters, like character classes, you know, mm-hmm. like your typical, like HeroQuest character classes, but I want them to be mice. And I was like, well, how can I do that? And then I came up with a story about how the people got changed into mice. And then the setting all started to make sense that it was in this castle that's now really big and they're really tiny. And it just all started to fall into place. The dice mechanic and the cheese was something that came about right from the very beginning because I wanted there to be this currency. And I even told it to Colby on the phone when we talked. I said, you know, I want there to be this currency that runs everything, and the currency is going to be cheese, and you pay for everything with cheese. And how you get cheese is a random element that's controlled by the dice. And so the more dice you roll, the better chance you have of gaining cheese. And when you fail a dice roll, the better chance you have of gaining cheese, which is a positive. So even when you're failing, you're building up momentum for doing something heroic.
And what's really cool about that mechanic that I was talking with my wife about is that then it works opposite for the enemies because when you're lucking out at first and the enemies are missing, they're also gaining more cheese on the minion wheel. And then eventually that turns into like a oh crap moment where you're, you know, suddenly you have a surge plus a bunch more minions on the board and it gets really hard kind of out of in a surprising way, I think.
This whole like... losing a role but benefiting because of cheese is something that really resonates with children. I mean, because there's very little of those sour moments in the game where children feel defeated, even when they're. And I know I read a lot of stories about kids who hoard their cheese. They just love gathering up as much cheese as possible. They won't spend them on abilities or anything like that. And I just think it's cute because they feel like they're winning even when they've lost so many rolls. Because, you know, every time you roll cheese, you're basically losing at whatever you're trying to do.
One thing that I was really surprising to me, because in cooperative games, I think it's the element that like gets the least amount of treatment a lot of times and ends up shortchanging the game, is the difficulty curve. Because I when I got the game, I played the first scenario with my wife and we kind of breezed through it, like, you know, because I'm assuming it's kind of meant to show you the gameplay. And I was like, oh, well, this is going to be easy, like a lot of cooperative games are. And then it took us three tries to beat the second scenario. and I was like, okay, I can see this. And like since then, I've realized how to play the game, so it's kind of flattened out a little bit. But it was surprisingly challenging, because a lot of times the enemies, you know, can get a bunch of cheese out of nowhere, and then it, you know, you can only plan so far ahead for that kind of thing. And there's a lot of little strategic choices for it being, you know, a very kid-friendly and easy-to-teach game. I think it has a cool depth and cool difficulty curve. Did you spend a lot of time on that, like, on tuning that kind of difficulty curve of the game? Or?
Yeah, I wrote an article for HeroScape years ago called My Favorite Games Are the Close Ones. I noticed a trend in my own gaming where if the game was close, if it was a really close photo finish, then I didn't care whether I won or lost. It was always very satisfying to have a very close finish. And so I knew going in with my statistics that I wanted to create a game that would continually supply those close finishes. If I could have every game session have the mice all wounded up and running for a tree and being dive bombed by a bird and just barely making it there by the fur on their tail, then if I can have every game moment be like that, then I've really succeeded. And it's really hard to do, especially in a very random luck swingy game like Mice and Mystics. But I think that I've come really close to giving that feeling. And for so many players, it happens, you know. If I could just have that spark happen a few times, then it really captures people to have that feeling of that tension that builds up and then that real satisfying release when they've won the scenario.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think one of the things that Mice and Mystics does really well, speaking of sort of that kind of that tension and that culmination of the elements, is it sort of does a very good job of telling the story, and it hits those storytelling beats. And part of that is because you have a mechanic where it's like, you know, if you fail your attack roll, you're still benefiting from that. So there's an ebb and a flow to the way the game's going. One interesting thing to me about this game, and I think you mentioned it on the Board Game Geek interview, where you talked about it being sort of an heirloom game, where it's a game that you'll play and you'll pass along from generation to generation. And while it does have sort of a replayability, because, you know, you want to try out the different scenarios, you want to try the different characters, it very much does also have an end to the game. I mean, you're telling a cohesive story from beginning to end. Now, coming from a design perspective, how much did you want to have that be play into people's experience of the game? How much did you kind of want them to experience that story and have it sort of have a conclusion?
I very much wanted that to be a large part of the game experience for Mice and Mystics. I've noticed that there's a lot of games out there that you can play that have wonderfully fluid mechanics and they're extremely enjoyable. But not a lot of games out there are really, really thick with story. And I just felt like that was something that really needed, some designer needed to step up and really do that. And that was just me. And this game just seemed to cry out for it, you know?
You know, this is the type of game that I look at and I'm like, this is an awesome design, because it, not only is the game itself, the mechanics are very elegant and, you know, it's fun to play, but that is you as the designer of the game are also just telling a story. And I think that's where you look at a game and it becomes undeniably a form of art, where it's like, you know, you have a tale to tell, you have a purpose for what the characters are going through, and there's, you know, rises and falls, and it's very much crafted that way. I mean, the easy thing almost would be to make a game where there's just, you know, random dungeons and it goes on forever and ever and you can keep playing, you know, for as long as you want. But having a game where it's you actually have a story and you get invested emotionally in the characters, I think is something special.
Yeah, I actually, when I told that game, the idea of the game to someone, they were like, oh, so you play through it once and then you're done. And I'm like, well, maybe. I mean, you can play it more, but like, I'm only halfway done, and I'm, like, super excited to finish the story, you know? Like, I think it's, like, a positive to me, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we want, you know, we, like, quantify our fun in, like, the hours a game lasts, as opposed to, like, the immersiveness and, like, how fun the game actually is while we're playing it, because tons of games go on forever, but you don't want to play them forever.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that about it. Now, when I wanted to pick up Mice and Mystics, I told the our friend Marguerite, who works at our local game store, I was like, oh, I think the next game I'm going to buy is Mice and Mystics. I've been looking into it. I'm pretty excited about it. And she said, good luck getting a copy because we are sold out already. And I was like, oh, no. And I eventually did get a copy. But so I take it at that point that the game has been pretty successful and most of the reviews I've read are positive. Were you, did you know that it was going to be well received or were you unsure and were excited to get that good reception?
Well, I'm kind of like a split personality where that's concerned. There were times where I thought, oh man, my game is so freaking awesome. It's going to get huge, awesome reviews. And those were times when I felt really confident about it. But most of the time, it was sheer terror, knowing that my work will be judged by so many people. And in the end, I think that you know, most of the reviews that I've read are any time that anybody has written anything negative about it, I think that their points are valid. I didn't create a perfect game. My game is the game that I created because I'm a quirky person, and this is the kind of thing I love, but it doesn't mean that everybody's going to love it. I'm just happy that so many people understood what I was going for. I didn't even know if people would kind of get it, since it is kind of a quirky little game. It's real heavy on story and real swingy with the luck and dependent on dice, and I know that these things get, they get criticized heavily out there in the world of board game reviewing and whatnot, but I just feel fortunate that so many people have embraced Mice and Mystics, even with all of its little quirkiness and stuff, and they understood where it came from, and they saw that. They saw that it's a collaborative effort from a lot of people who really care.
One of my main reasons for buying it is was that, you know, I'm going to have a kid soon, and I thought, man, I can't wait to play games with my son. That's, like, what I'm looking forward to more than just about anything. And that year, when I watched Rodney from Watch It Played on YouTube, he did a video teaching how to play the game, and that's what got me to want to get it, was my immediate thought was, like, this is the perfect game to play with your kids. Do you get to receive a lot of feedback from people who play the game with their kids and like it that way? Or
yeah, that's just, like, one of the most rewarding things is the emails and the Twitter messages and the geek mail and stuff that I get from parents who've bonded with their spouses or with their children through my game and have introduced a whole new generation of gamers to the world of board games in a way that they hadn't been able to do before. And those kinds of breakthroughs that people have where they have these moments that'll stick out in their memories, you know, those kids are going to grow up someday and they're going to look back and they're going to remember playing Mice and Mystics with their dad, you know, and they're going to want to play it with their kids, hopefully, you know. I mean, that's what I talk about in Heirloom Game is I wanted to create a game that would transcend those age boundaries and just really create an experience that people can enjoy at any age.
You mentioned that you're a really big advocate of user-created content, essentially, for games. Have you has anybody sent you their Mice and Mystics extra storybooks or extra rules they've created?
I've had people send me extra rules and rules ideas and stuff. I had one person, his name is Paul Jeffries, sent me a little, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the with Cat's Cradle, the downloadable chapter that we put out on our website.
The kind of Halloween themed one, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't picked it up, but I plan to once I finish the regular story.
He made a little figure that matched one of the characters in that chapter and sent it to me in a you know, custom playing pieces and stuff like that, and it's fantastic. I had one of my extremely artistic friends created a giant hand-carved Mice and Mystics wooden box that looks like a giant book or a giant tome. And it latches and everything, and then you open it up, and it's the perfect size to fit the game box inside the giant wood box.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
It's really beautiful. But nobody has... I think the game's still too early. People are still playing through the story. And I think it's still too early to get any kind of user-created chapters or what have you. But one individual did let me know that he's finishing up an entire group of chapters, an entire story book that he's done on his own that I just can't wait to play.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
I'm going to solo that bad boy. Like, as soon as he gets it, I'm just going to solo it because I love playing solo. So
that was something that we were wondering, because there's not a lot of games out there that are actually can really scratch that solo game itch, I think. You know, and something like Mice and Mystics, where it has a storyline, actually, and you're progressing through, is I think the one thing that might get me to play a solo game is something like Mice and Mystics, where the story is inextricably linked to the gameplay as well.
I remember there was a series of books that were called Lone Wolf back in the 80s that had that sort of solitaire story going on. It was a choose-your-own-adventure-like I'm curious too. How are there challenges between designing for single player and multiplayer in the same game?
Yeah, there are challenges. You have to if you have anywhere in the back of your mind the intentions of honoring the solo players out there, then you have to make sure that everything is easily manageable so that they don't have to have too much bookkeeping involved in playing the game. And when you're designing a game, if you can design a game that's playable solo, that's also very beneficial for the design process, because I try everything out before I let my playtesters to it. I try everything out on my own playing solo. So before the playtesters get it, it's already been pre-tested just solo. Although you can't bring a game all the way to the store shelves just purely playtesting it solo, because you know you'll spoil your own results. You can really help the design process by at least playing through some stuff solo beforehand.
So I think what people are probably eager to know is what's next for Mice and Mystics. Are there plans for storybooks or expansions that will add on to it?
Yes, obviously everything's dependent upon the success of the game and how well sales are. But so far, Mice and Mystics has been selling really well. And we have a series of releases that we have planned. Colby Plat Hat Games is a small publishing company, so you have to take that into consideration with their release schedule. They only have the resources to do so much at any given time. But the first expansion for Mice and Mystics is already in editing right now, and so it's well on its way to reaching the end users. It's called Heart of Glorm. And oddly enough, one of the craziest things about Mice and Mystics, since it's so story-driven, if I create an expansion that is a continuation of the story, then I really can't talk that much about the story, because there's still players that are playing through the first storybook. But yeah, it's a smaller storybook. It only has 6 chapters. This fits into our plan for releasing small expansions at a lower price point that kind of tell alternative tales but use the same components from the base that they're supporting. So Heart of Glorm supports the base game, and it uses all the components from the base game, but it adds an extra villain miniature and a new mouse. And then the story takes place in the castle, but I can't tell you much about it because there's still players out there. I don't want to spoil it for any of the players who are still playing through the main story. But it does take place in the same setting. It's just things have gotten kind of different, and the mice have a new challenge inside the castle that they need to take on. And they get the help of Nira, the mouse. She's a wild mystic, kind of like a druid. She's like a druid. And she hears a distress call from the forest. The tree, the Barksburg tree that the mice are living in, is in trouble. And so she feels called to come and assist this tree. And then she gets swept up in the adventure with our heroes. And so she's going to be a big part of this new set of adventures.
I'm so excited for a druid mouse. You have no idea. druids are like one of my favorite like Dungeons and Dragons archetypes, you know, to play. So now I'm super psyched to play a druid.
She's kind of like my way of honoring my wife. My wife is a yoga teacher, and she's a naturalist, and she's just very earthy and beautiful and strong and fiery. And so is Nira. Nira is this, you know, a wild mystic mouse and she just cares about nature, and she's just, you know, animal loving druid. And she's got her own set of powers and stuff that she comes with, and she'll be a great addition to the mouse adventures.
I think that's one of the rules of game design is you always do the first expansion is always for the misses. The second one you get to make personally for you.
I was gonna say the rest of the game design community, you're making them look bad. Now they're gonna be like, oh, Jerry Hawthorne, now we have to design an expansion to honor our wives.
Oh, that's awesome. When you were first kind of developing Mice and Mystics, and you said, you know, you scrambled to get it ready for Gen Con, and, you know, of course, you know, you have lofty goals. Did you actually plan, or were you starting to plan out what expansions could be at that point? Because it seems like if you're going to succeed in the game industry today, you have to know that if you have a successful game, that game has to be ready to make expansions. It's just sort of like it's a given at this point.
Yeah.
So was that something that you thought of beforehand?
Well, fortunately, I worked for Hasbro, and Hasbro, when I did some design work for Battleship Galaxies and stuff like that, Hasbro, they designed stuff like 2 years in advance. And so Craig Van Ness, one of the big designers over there at Hasbro, he has a saying. He says, we prepare for success. And basically with whatever they do, they want to be prepared for success. And so I kind of took that to heart. And when I designed Mice and Mystics, after I got done with the first storybook, I immediately started diving in and designing anything else that came to mind, because I didn't know, I mean, if there was a chance that the game could be popular, I wanted to be prepared, even if it's just mentally, I wanted to be prepared for that. And so there's some stuff that's coming out that that has been designed for a couple of years now. So,
is there at this point any like loose release time frame for Heart of Glorm, or is it one of those? Is it a soon, but you know, we don't know exactly when kind of thing?
There's still some like in this editing phase that we're in. There's still some unknowns because we have to go at the pace that everybody can go. And most of us that are working on this, we all have full-time jobs. And so everything we do in the game design, we do in those desperate moments late at night or early in the morning when we can fit it in. We're parents, we are husbands, we're, you know, workaholics, and you can't rush some of this stuff. And there's things that I've finished up with that I've passed along to other people. And then when they get done with their part, then they'll pass it along to the next guy in line. And when it's all done, and it all looks really good, then Colby hits the green light, and then that's the moment that we can predict. But I sure would like this to be available at Gen Con. I would love it if we made Heart of Glorm available at Gen Con.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
I would love to be able to sit and play it with the fans out there.
We would love that as well, since we would be some of those fans.
For sure.
That's my wish. That's my wish. Who knows whether it'll come true or not?
Yeah, we'll put a disclaimer at the top of the show. Be like, Jerry Hawthorne did not promise that the game would be out by Gen Con. Please listen very carefully.
We can edit it, though, so it sounds like a promise. And then just be huge jerks. And be like, no, guys. No. He said by Gen Con. That's what he said. We're looking forward to that. I think this is going to be probably our first Gen Con that some of us go to. Is this going to be the first Gen Con after Mice and Mystics has been out already?
Yeah, After it's been out in circulation, yes. Last year at Gen Con, we had, I think, 5 demo copies available, and 3 of which we were using and 2 of which we gave out to certain individuals like Tom Vassell.
That's awesome. I look forward to the fans getting a chance to thank you in person, because I think, Aaron's has pointed out throughout the whole show, I think this game resonates with a lot of people for a lot of different reasons, and a lot of it's very emotional reasons. You know, this is a game that you can play with your family, and you know, there's games that you can do that with, but this is a special type of game for that purpose. So.
I remember when I talked to you, you talked about Plaid Hat and how much you liked the publisher. So I just want to make sure. So Plaid Hat though is doing well and going strong, and we can expect more great games like Dungeon Run and Summoner Wars and that from them.
Yes. As far as I know, Plaid Hat Games is continuing to grow. Colby has set goals for himself, and he's the kind of person that you don't meet that many people like Colby in your lifetime. He's a brilliant young man, and he's the kind of person that, you know, when he sets out to do something, he does it, and he's probably one of the most genuine and talented individuals I've ever had the pleasure of working with. His company is, and if you ever thought in your heart, you know, like, what kind of company would I want to make? You know, if I could control a company, you know, what kind of ethics would I want to promote? Colby has done that, and he runs his company so close to his own ethics that I can't say enough good stuff about him, and I think his company deserves anybody's business, and I think that that he's proving that, and I think that's mainly one of the main reasons why his company is growing so quickly, is people recognize that he's getting the benefit of that.
Yeah, just as a consumer of games, I would totally be comfortable saying that, like, at this point, I haven't played every game, every Plaid Hat game, but I have played Summoner Wars, and I love Mice and Mystics, obviously, and I really, really like Dungeon Run as well. So to me, that's, I like it when a brand becomes a point where I can just see the emblem on the box and go, oh, I'm interested in that, because that's, you know, they made these many things that I like before, and there's a few companies like that, but Plaid Hat is becoming one of those for me personally. So
yeah, I mean, I think what you're talking about though, Jerry, is really important, because I think as, you know, the internet becomes more prevalent and people are like very savvy consumers nowadays, you know, to have a company that actually has an ethical background and actually treats like its employees and its, you know, well, and treats the community with the respect that it deserves, I think that goes a really long way. And I think, you know, if Plaid Hat continues to grow, that will definitely be an element of their success moving forward. I mean, you look at, you know, Fred Hicks and Evil Hat. What's with the hats? It's all hats.
Everyone loves hats.
But, you know, yeah, the same things that Fred Hicks is doing with Evil Hat, where it's just, you know, the community is rallying behind these companies because they're led by good people who genuinely care about the product they're putting out. I think that's so, so important.
Yeah, especially nowadays when the world seems just so sterile sometimes, and so there's so much internet, massive amounts of information that we're being bombarded with, and it's nice to see that there's companies out there that are doing things, even though they're modern and they're hip and they're in tune with what's going on, and they also have their heart in those old-fashioned principles that I think kind of really resonate with us. I know they do with me.
Absolutely. Well, Jerry, it's been a pleasure. Now, we do a segment on our show called Things We're Excited About.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of prepped you at the beginning, so hopefully you've had a chance to, while you're talking, come up with something. Is there anything that is on the horizon that you are particularly excited about, be it games or movies or anything really? What is Jerry Hawthorne excited about?
I'll just list them real quick. I'm excited. Okay. I'm excited about. I'm going to a small game gathering coming up this spring. I'm really excited to sit down and play, you know, a whole weekend worth of games with my friends, and I'm really interested in playing a big fat, you know, 6-player game of Zombicide. I think that's going to be a blast. I love Zombicide. I think it's fantastic. I'm also excited about Ender's Game coming out this November, starring Harrison Ford and Ben Kingsley, I believe. And I'm excited about BioShock Infinity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The board game and the video game.
Wait, there's a board game? I didn't know about the board game.
What? Oh, okay. Well, Plaid Hat Games is, they've been given the honor of doing the BioShock Infinity board game that should be coming out this year.
How did I not know about that?
Yeah, now I'm really excited about that.
it's just, and I've been behind the scenes on this one, so I've gotten to see. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Isaac Vega. You should have him on the show. The guy's like a genius. Game design, young game designer, and he designed City of Remnants for Plaid Hat, and he's also designed BioShock Infinite. The board game, Siege of Columbia, is the name of the board game, and it's going to be beautiful. My best friend Chad is the sculptor who sculpted the miniatures and designed by Isaac Vega, with a big bunch of Colby Dauch put in there. It's going to be awesome. The art is just going to be off the hook.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad that that news was brought to us via this interview. every time we've had a guest. Last time we had a guest, we found out that the Norwegians have the craziest LARPs, and that was news to us. And now we found out that
we got to keep having guests, so we keep learning things.
Yeah, it's been educational.
You guys have a great podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. We're gonna make that a soundbite and just play it all the time throughout the episode.
That's going on the soundboard for sure. Well, Jerry, it was a pleasure talking to you. Hopefully, we would love to have you on the show again. Like I said, this might be some of our first Gen Con, but maybe we can get closer, figuring out maybe a date or what have you for Heart of Glorm. We can talk about that a little bit. But it's been a pleasure to have you. We thank you so much for reaching out to us and giving us the opportunity to talk to you. Is there anything you want to say to anyone as a parting before we let you go?
Hi, Mom.
If your mom listens to this, I would be shocked. I would be floored. If Jerry's mom is listening to this, thank you, because you're one of several that listen
to this show. Hey, thank you so much, guys.
No problem. Thank you for being on. It was awesome talking to you.
Good night, fellas.
Good night. And that was our interview with Jerry Hawthorne. Nice guy.
Super nice guy.
I am blown away. He is an unending font of positivity.
Right? He fits really well on the show. Well, he fits really well with 2/3 of the show.
he was provided an excellent counterbalance to a certain part of the show and their never-ending curmudgeonism.
Well, I can tell that when Dell is bombarded with positive rays, he basically becomes like... paralyzed. Like, he didn't speak that much. It's sort of like his weakness.
He was like, I feel good. What is this?
Yeah.
My body doesn't know how to process that emotion. So
right. You're like the ghost in Mario, where but instead of someone looking at you, they have to say something nice, and you're just frozen. You don't know what to do. But the minute they say something even neutral, you just turn on and you just become.
You hone Ooh. In on the cynicism.
Yeah. Oh, it was really good. He dropped the name of the expansion, which I didn't know about.
Yeah, Heart of Glorm, new druid-themed mouse Nira, I believe he said was the name. I'm pretty excited about that.
I want to play that BioShock Infinite board game. I don't know if you guys know the plot of BioShock Infinite, but you play a guy who got kicked out of the Pinkertons for being evil. And the Pinkertons are a hilariously over-the-top, real-life evil company. So I'm really curious.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. And I want to play this board game now.
Cool. Well, we heard what Jerry Hawthorne is excited about. But now let's get to what we are excited about. And we will start that segment right now. Now, to the what we're excited about portion, let's start with NPC Aaron. Aaron, what are you excited about this week?
Next month, I'm starting a second game group, a monthly game group, and it's going to be split board games and RPGs like we do. But it's going to be largely people who are just now getting into games or have never really played board games or RPGs. So I think we might start with Fiasco as our first game to get people involved. And no, Dell, you're not invited. I knew you would want to be just because of Fiasco, but too much of an expert. You know too much.
I've seen things.
You have. Yeah, but I'm pretty excited to teach people some games. I had a recent get-together where I showed some of my non-gamer friends some games, and they were pretty excited about it, and they talked about wanting to get together and play more games. So it's going to be a kind of beer and pretzels game night at my house. Del, what are you excited about in the world of Magic? I mean, games.
I'm actually super excited for a website I just found out about called inkedplaymats.com that does custom one-off printing of playmats for any card game or board game that you could use a playmat for, not just Magic. Mm-hmm. For instance, the World of Warcraft card game, or I guess you could put the playmat underneath a Catan game. That's
I use Magic playmats for my mouse pads. So I have like three in my office right now for my various mouse pads.
Yeah, so they do very reasonably costed, high-end quality playmats. And I'm getting one put together that's the are you guys familiar with The Last Supper? The painting.
The famous painting? Yes, I am familiar with The Last Supper.
For those of you who can't see The Last Supper because this is radio, but it's you know, it's a picture of everybody.
I think people know what The Last Supper is.
Well, I don't know.
Wait. Mine was macaroni and cheese.
No. Can we just give our listeners a modicum of credit? Just a slight sliver of credit to let them know what The Last Supper is.
Okay.
How are you going to bastardize The Last Supper?
Battlestar Galactica.
I love it.
Patricia Helfer as Jesus.
I love it. Has this been done?
The image already exists. They did the Battlestar Galactica cast did a photo shoot for Entertainment Weekly a while ago, and EW was good enough to release it as a super, super high-res photo, and I'm getting that done up as a playmat.
That is awesome. Now, so this place, it was inkedplaymats.com?
Yeah, inked, like past tense of ink, the verb, mm-hmm. Inkedplaymats, plural.com.
Okay. Cool. And so it's actually like printed on. It's not like an artist that's drawing on it.
Right.
It's just one off.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, that's really
cool.
They
do have bulk. They do have bulk things. So if we wanted to get up, say, some NPC cast playmats, give those away as prizes or something, that's totally doable.
That would be pretty awesome. I would be down with that. That's really cool, Del. Even though Aaron kind of poo-pooed you a little bit because it was pseudo magic related.
Yeah, well, you made it sound like it was more magic related, and now I feel bad about making fun of you for always being excited about magic.
As you should. Okay, so I guess I'll go to what I'm excited about. Now, this is I'm going to tell the story behind this, and I spoke about it a little bit on our Facebook. I was looking at our WordPress stats for npccast.com, and I can see where people are coming to our site from, what links, they've clicked. So I can see, like, you know, 6 people or 12 people come from Reddit or, you know, from this forum or that forum. And the other day I saw something I didn't recognize, and I was like, oh, that's weird. And it was from a site called burnedfx.com. That's burned, letter F, letter X.com. I was like, oh, that's rather curious. Let me check this out. I just want to see, because maybe they said something nice about us or something, and, you know, that would make me feel good. And so I went and checked it out, and it's actually a podcast. It's called the Delvers Podcast, and they put a link to our actual play, our TPK episodes, on the sidebar of their podcast. And I was like, wow, that's incredibly humbling. Like, that's really awesome. So, of course, you know, I decided to check them out. Now, I was floored when I listened to this, when I was actually able to listen to their actual plays. What this is it's the Dungeon Master. His name is Jay. He is playing Dungeons & Dragons, like original Dungeons & Dragons. I think halfway through their episode, they switched to a different system, but it's still very old school, like AD&D style Dungeons & Dragons. He plays Dungeons & Dragons with his girlfriend, and her two daughters. You have Kay, who is 9 years old, and Sue, who is 12 years old, and her name is Tess. His girlfriend's name is Tess. And he's playing Dungeons & Dragons with these young ladies, and it's amazing. Like, these girls are incredibly awesome. Kay is like a badass. She's like an assassin in the first, like in the first first episode of the podcast. And you know, he talks about before the episode starts, he gives a little premise of what's going to happen. And he's like, you know, I asked her why she was an assassin. I didn't ask her for her background or anything, but the story that she gave was way in depth. And you listen to the actual episode, and she gives this huge detailed story incorporating characters of hers and her family's from previous campaigns they played in. And she's like, yeah, now this happened, and then this happened, and now my character's like an assassin. And it's awesome to hear these young ladies play this game.
Yeah, I listened to a few episodes, and Kay is one shrewd gamer, that's for sure. I really like it. I mean, Jay does an excellent job editing. I listened to the newest sequence, where they explore a dungeon called Barrow Maze, and it's very creepy, and there's tons of ambient, like, creepy sounds, and all of the edits are done as, like, fast-forward noises that just make it even creepier sounding. So you're really on the edge of your seat while you listen to this, and I really like it. It's one of the actual plays like that I like the best that I've listened to, you know, aside from maybe TPK.
Well, but. I mean, it's close to home. It's close. The one thing I'll say is I wrote Jay an email, and because as I mentioned in episode 10, you know, I've been a gamer for a very long time. I was very young, and so I sent an email. I was like, you know what? Like, I was Kay's age when I started playing RPGs. And it brings you back. Like, it's so cool to hear young people. I know that, Dale, you talked about, you know, it's awesome to play RPGs with younger kids or your nephews or your nieces. And this sort of podcast basically encapsulates that. It's really cool. If you get the chance to check it out, the episodes are short. I mean, they're like between 15 and 30 minutes. They're short. They're weekly, but you know, it's really quick. Check it out. Jay does a great job. He basically, you know, he cuts out a lot of like the uninteresting parts, and he'll do a little, you know, a beginning and the end. He'll kind of tell you, or there'll be parts where in the middle where he'll fill you in on the story and says, okay, now they go to this place or that place. So there's some narration involved, but he keeps it really tight.
And what is the exact website again?
The exact website is burnedfx.com. I'll put it in the show notes, of course, but it's burnedfx.com. Anyways, if you get a chance to check it out, I can't recommend it enough. Delver's podcast, it's really cool, and I want to thank them again on air for linking to us. We really, really appreciate it. We're humbled by that. It's really cool. And I think that's going to be it for this episode, guys, right?
I don't have anything more. I'm out.
Yeah.
You're out of everything to say?
I'm out of stuff.
Well, okay. I guess then that will be the end of this episode. We would love to get feedback from you. We've mentioned where you can reach us on Twitter, via email, on Facebook. You can, of course, go to npccast.com as well and see all of the podcast episodes that you could possibly imagine. But until next time, you will add 1,000 XP to your character sheet. Bye-bye.
NPCcast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/npccast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.